everybody. Welcome to the Covert Report with Susan Lindauer. I have a fantastic Douglas Valentine, who is the author of a series of books, The CIA as Organized Crime. And his called The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Corrupt America and the World. Now, this is a fascinating. We're going to bring Douglas on immediately, but he did out researching the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and he was given, he's going to talk about how William Colby, former CIA director, gave him direct access to assets who had been involved in this program. And it was Douglas who broke this story. And then we're going to continue talking about the population surveillance, the drug trafficking. The CIA is immersed in criminal activities, has become a major crime syndicate, as Douglas will show. Douglas, welcome this morning.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, now let's start by how did you get involved in this? How did you get chosen by William Colby? And tell everybody, you know, whatever personal stories you can, because William Colby ended up being assassinated, we think. Well, we'll talk.
I was not a member of the government or anything like that. I'm 67 years old, and I always wanted to be a writer. But I never had anything to write about. And then I went back to school for a year, and that was in 1980. Coincidentally, at that time, my father had his second open-heart surgery, and he was having a hard time recovering. And he called me up on the phone, and he said the doctors told him if he wanted to get better, he had to tell me what happened to him. He had to talk about what happened to him in World War II. My father was a soldier in World War II. So he called me up around 1981 and 1980, and he said, come on home, Doug. I got a story I want to tell you. And it was unbelievable. It just blew my mind. And he had never told anybody what happened to him in the war, but he'd actually been a prisoner of war in the Philippines. And he was in a camp, a Japanese prisoner of war camp, where the enlisted men mutinied against the officers in the camp. The conditions were so horrible in the camp. And the commanding officer, who was a British major, was, you know, he made a deal with the Japanese. And when a couple of prisoners tried to escape, he had them, he notified the Japanese, and they went out and they captured these soldiers, and they brought them back and they beheaded them in camp. And my father was part of a mutiny of enlisted men against the officers in this camp. And the camp happened to be in on the island of Leyte in the town of Tacloban, which is where MacArthur landed in October of 1944 when the United States returned to the Philippines. And so the camp was liberated in October of 1944. And my father had survived. Not many of the people in this prison camp had survived, but he had survived. He was down to like 110 pounds. Yeah, he was 6 feet tall. He was only 19 years old. And he had spent his 2 years of his youth in this POW camp. And anyway, when the camp was liberated, he was immediately isolated from the other prisoners, and he was put in a hospital in Brisbane, Australia. And he was told that he was going to be brought up on charges and put in front of a firing squad because they killed this English major.
And then the major was the one who told the Japanese how to hunt down the escapees. But then because they mutinied against this guy who was a monster, oh.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but my father was haunted by his participation in this murder. He did, you know, I mean, it wasn't something that he did happily. You know, I mean, it was when people are put in situations, life and death situations, they do things they would not normally do, things that haunt them for the rest of their lives. And my father, eventually, after a while, the military came back to him. They said, "Well, we're not going to put you on trial. We're not going to execute you, but we're going to give you a false history. And if you ever tell anybody, then you're going to be in big trouble." So my father spent the next 20 years, 30 years, 40 years harboring this horrible secret, and it was contributed to his heart attacks. He had his first coronary when he was 45, and a lot of it had to do with carrying around this deep, dark secret for all these years. You know, I mean, it's just very stressful. And if you know anybody with PTSD, you know, it's a horrible thing. And so anyway, my father told me this fabulous story, and all of a sudden I had something to write about, and I wrote my first book, which was called The Hotel Tacloban, which is what the prisoners called this POW camp. And that book was published in 1984. And all of a sudden now I was a writer. And I didn't know what I was going to write about next. But I wanted, there were, for people my age, my generation, 67 years old, there were three big issues. There was the civil rights movement. There was the Vietnam War. And there was drugs. And so I thought, I'll write another book, but I want to write a book about soldiers who went to Vietnam and were forced to carry secrets, like my father was forced to carry as a result of World War II. And so I went to a veterans hospital in New Hampshire where I was living, and I asked the director if there was any subjects about the Vietnam War that hadn't been written about because of secrecy. And the guy looked at me and he said, "The Phoenix Program." And I said, "Well, what's that? You know, I've never heard about it." And he said, "Well, look, there's a guy here in the hospital, in the VA hospital, who was in the special forces, and he was in the Phoenix program. And I know about this because he talks about it in therapy. I'll set up an interview with you with him. And then he can tell you about it." I said, "Great." And then I called him back in about a week. I said, "I haven't heard from you. What happened?" And he said, "Well, the guy won't talk to you about it. He's afraid that if he talks about the Phoenix program, he'll lose his VA benefits." And it was the same exact thing with my father, where there's this whole segment of the American population, many of them who are veterans, who are walking around with PTSD because they did things and they saw things that they're not allowed to talk about. And it drives them crazy. And, you know, I mean, I think your listeners may know that more Vietnam veterans have committed suicide than were actually killed in the war. There were 55,000 American soldiers killed in the Vietnam War, but somewhere like 100,000 or 150,000 have committed suicide because of the horrible things they have to carry around with. And they're not allowed to talk about it, either because they were involved in secret operations or because the things were just so horrible that people who are civilians just wouldn't understand, you know, how could you do that? How could you do that kind of a thing? And they'd understand what it means to be a soldier. But having written this book about my father, I knew what it meant to be a soldier. And when I decided to write about the Phoenix program, I sent a copy of this book, The Hotel Tacloban, to William Colby. William Colby, and this is in like 1984, William Colby had been a career CIA officer. He'd been in the OSS in World War II. And after World War II, when they created the CIA, he went into the CIA and he started out, you know, at the bottom and worked his way up. And by 1973, he actually became the director of Central Intelligence. He was the guy that ran the CIA. And he spent a lot of his career in Vietnam, and he was largely responsible for creating the Phoenix program. And when there were congressional investigations into Phoenix in 1970, 1971, it was Colby who testified to Congress and defended the Phoenix program. So he was the individual who was most closely associated with the Phoenix program. Now, I came from nowhere.
Douglas, I want you to stop right now and tell everybody, this is Douglas Valentine. and he's the author of a series of books on the CIA. The new book is The CIA as Organized Crime, Douglas Valentine. Okay. And tell and remind listeners of what the Phoenix is.
Yeah. So I sent Colby a copy of this book, The Hotel Talk Loban, and because it was from nowhere, because I was a nobody, I wasn't a journalist, I wasn't a famous writer, but he read the book and he said, okay, come on down to Washington and I'll tell you what the Phoenix program was about. Because you understand what it means to be a soldier, and you'll understand what Americans who participated in Phoenix had to do, and why it was a secret program. You know, he really thought that I could be sympathetic to the CIA. Now, I didn't really know anything about the CIA at the time. I was reading books about it, and I was pursuing lines of inquiry into the Phoenix program apart from Colby. So I was gathering information, and I knew from the few published reports that there were, from a Freedom of Information Act request that I had filed. I got some documents from the State Department. And I had been talking to a lot of guys who had been in the Phoenix program at the very bottom level, soldiers who were assigned to the Phoenix program. So I had an idea what it was about, but I didn't really know that much about the CIA. What I knew about the Phoenix program was that it had been organized by the CIA in Vietnam in 1967. And it was a coordinating mechanism. At the time, in 1967 in Vietnam, there were maybe 25 or 30 different programs that were run by the CIA or the military or the State Department's Agency for International Development, which advised the South Vietnamese police forces. And all these different programs to win over the population, the population of South Vietnam, and bring them over to America's side. And they were having a very difficult time doing this because the people basically supported the communists that were going to, you know, we're going to help you out. And they talked to the people, they knew the people, they were of the people. And so the people were resisting and they didn't want America in South Vietnam. So in 1967, the CIA coordinated all these programs, brought them all together under what was called a General Staff for Pacification. And the whole focus of this General Staff for Pacification, the Phoenix program, was to destroy the Viet Cong infrastructure. The communists had ages in hamlets. They had a very sophisticated system of coordinating people down at the village level, the hamlet level, and the CIA decided that the only way it could win over the South Vietnamese population was to kill off all these people, to kill off all the members of the secret political apparatus that was like a shadow government. They were farmers by day.
Let me interrupt you right there, Douglas, for 1 minute. What the Phoenix program set out to do was to eradicate all of the teachers, all of the judges, all of the civil service apparatus. Because the civil service, that would be the social work, they are villagers, okay? Not highly sophisticated peoples. So teachers would have been teachers and school administrators, and anyone who could read pretty much was going to be exterminated. Anybody who was like a mayor or elder. Village elders would be eradicated, and by that they would be killed. They would just be killed, and they wanted to destroy the functioning of this society.
And it depended on a lot on it's a very very sophisticated operation, and it it had, like I said, dozens of different aspects involved with it, of which one was, the biggest one, of course, is public information, what they told people about the Phoenix program. And they said the Phoenix program is designed to protect the people from terrorism, just like they tell you that the Department of Homeland Security is designed to protect you from terrorism, or, you know, they said it's going to protect you from Viet Cong, communist terrorism. Now, it didn't matter that all these people supported the communists, you know, they were going to be protected from themselves. And it created this whole perception among the population that people were required to actually do deeds that supported the South Vietnamese government, which was utterly corrupt. And it was completely dependent on the United States for all its technical support and everything. For example, the CIA advised the South Vietnamese Special Police. And I just wrote a series of articles about a South Vietnamese Special Police officer, a guy named Nguyen, and he's 86 years old. And I just wrote a series of articles about him. But the CIA, and it was this special branch of the South Vietnamese police force, which was at the forefront of the Phoenix program. And it was, had created this force in South Vietnam in 1954 and 1955. They actually, it was entirely funded by the CIA. It would be like, it functioned like the FBI. And it would be like our FBI is totally controlled and funded by the Soviets or something, or the Russians or the Chinese. You know, the Americans paid every salary. Every special policeman, his salary was paid by the CIA, and the CIA advised all these guys. And in 1965, they actually created, in South Vietnam, which was divided into 44 provinces. A province in South Vietnam was like a state in the United States. And the CIA, for the Special Police Force, built an interrogation center in 1965 in every one of these provinces. And it was staffed by special police officers who were advised by the CIA. And they totally concentrated on running clandestine operations to penetrate not only the communist apparatus, this Viet Cong infrastructure, but every other political party that was operating in South Vietnam. So they weren't just going after communists. They were going after any nationalist political party that was in opposition to the ruling military cabal that the CIA kept in power in South Vietnam. It would be like, you know, Trump deciding that the Democratic Party was, you know, the enemy. You know, so now we can use the
Democrats deciding the Trump
and control the Democrats.
Yeah,
and you know, so that's the extent that the CIA was able to actually control. It was able to totally control the political environment in South Vietnam through this special police force, which it totally funded and operated, to the extent that it built an interrogation center where really horrible, terrible things occurred. And this is why William Colby thought that I would be sympathetic, because, you know, my father had been in a prisoner of war camp, so I would understand somehow, you know, what it was for an American CIA officer to run one of these interrogation centers, which were just torture chambers, which was not uncommon for people, women, you know, I mean, they were bringing in people as young as 12, 13, 14 years old, working them over, trying to find out what they knew about this secret apparatus that was operating in the villages and the hamlets in South Vietnam. They would, you know, bring in women that, like you were saying, a teacher who, you know, maybe somebody fingered her and said that she was sympathetic to the women's liberation movement that was in South Vietnam. They bring her and they rape her and just, you know, just tell her if she didn't inform on everybody that she knew, that they'd kill her family. And they would. They would go out if they thought that somebody
would know that it was true.
They would just send out a special forces hit team and kill everybody and their family. And they, it was just incredibly violent. And as I started, you know, researching this and getting into the details, you know, I mean, it was horrifying for me. And at the same time, you know, I mean, I had gone in with an open mind, but I related because of my father had been a prisoner of war. I related more to the people who were being tortured than the CIA guys who were doing the torturing. You know, I mean, and I couldn't believe that Colby would be such an idiot to think that, I wouldn't, you know, my sympathies wouldn't be with the victims, you know. But Colby actually thought that I was going to do a sympathetic treatment of the book. And what he did was he started introducing me. And, you know, understanding the Phoenix program is a good way to start to understand the CIA, but actually being able to meet CIA officers and talk to them is a far better way to understand the CIA. And once Colby had gotten behind me, he started introducing me to very senior CIA officers. For example, when he was in the OSS in World War II, one of his buddies in the OSS was a guy named Evan Parker. And, Parker, like Colby, worked his way up through the CIA. And in 1967, Colby selected this guy, Evan Parker, who was his, you know, friend for over 20 years at this point, to be the first director of the Phoenix program in South Vietnam. Parker was actually the guy that ran the Phoenix Directorate in Saigon. And the Phoenix Directorate in Saigon had a staff of like 30 or 40 people. And it was computerized. And it kept records on everybody who was identified as having been a member of the secret apparatus that the CIA was trying to destroy. So it was the headquarters for this operation. And Evan Parker was the first director. And William Colby set me up in an interview with this guy. And this, you know, very early in my research into the Phoenix program. So I put on a suit and a tie, you know, like I was always, I'm kind of a waspy looking guy and kind of good looking and I'm smart and I'm well read. I had always been interested in English literature and always wanted to be a writer. So I was very presentable. And he sent me to Parker, which, do I have time to tell you about what happened?
Do, please do.
So I show up at Parker's house in Rockville, Maryland, and he's this avuncular old guy, you know, and he's a deacon in the local Episcopal church, and he's kind of tottering around because he's had a stroke, but he's okay, and he welcomes me in like one of the clan because Colby sent me to him, you know. So he, you know, if Colby sent me, I got to be okay. And he invites me up to his little, he has a little study up on the second floor of this nice little colonial style house, you know, nothing special. And, but very attractive. And we get up to the second floor. And for the first hour, we sat in his little studio. We didn't talk about the CIA or Phoenix. We talked about, English literature. His Parker's a Welsh name, and we talked about Welsh writers like Dylan Thomas and stuff like that. We just kind of figured, you know, we're getting to know each other, and there's a little coffee table in front of us, and on it is a stack of documents. And he gets up after about an hour and he says, "Well, Doug, I'm going to go downstairs and I'm going to make us some tea. I'll be gone for about 15 minutes. And he walks out of the room and leaves. And I'm looking at this pile of documents. So
that's exactly how they would do it.
Yeah, so I opened up the top document and it's a roster.
Break. Douglas, we're on break now. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Covert Report. My guest today is Douglas Valentine, author of The CIA as Organized Crime. If the chat room could please type that into the description for me, I'd appreciate it. I cannot access the chat room from the computer that I'm using this afternoon because Douglas has a little bit of a hearing impediment, so we're using an older computer that I have with a webcam on it as opposed to my new computer. So there's a little bit of that. That's why I'm not in the chat room today. But everybody, it's Douglas Valentine, and this is a fascinating story of the real insider scoop of the Phoenix program and the CIA's history of involvement as a crime syndicate. Douglas was just talking about his meeting with Mr. Parker, and one of the old school ways that the CIA would, the older guys, if they wanted to share something with you, they'd put something he's describing exactly how the old timers would do it. They you put a stack of papers on the table in between and kind of, you know, tap it and say, I'm going to be gone for 15 minutes or half an hour. And they give you a chance to look over the papers, but they can say that they never gave you the papers. That you see, that's how they play the game. And so they Parker could look his superiors in the eye and say, I never gave it to him. Gosh, you know, he I don't know if you found it, but I don't, never gave it to him. And that's how they, when I was having my fight with the feds, they played games like that too. And we're used to those games, but you know, in terms of deny, it is layered with deniability, as you're about to find out. So Douglas, please continue.
Military people, and because one of the things that people don't really understand about the CIA, but it's intimately connected with the military, and the military officers are very often assigned to the CIA. They're not actually a CIA officer, but they work for the CIA, and they take their orders from the CIA, and so. More than half the people who are working for the CIA's Phoenix program at the headquarters were military people, and I got their names and their ranks and their social security number and their military ID number from this roster, and I was able to go out. And of course, in these days, 1985, it meant I had to go to the library and look up their names on all the phone books. You know, I mean, I would spend hours and hours at the Springfield City Library looking through phone books to try and find these guys. And I use the military stud books and all sorts of, it's not like you can go on the internet. There was no internet. They had ARPNET was beginning to start back then, but it was very laborious and time consuming. But every time I would find one of these guys, I would say, well, Armin Parker gave me your name. And the guy would say, well, come on over and let's talk, you know, because, And Parker himself said, you know, he said, Colby's the director of Central Intelligence, even though he's no longer the director of Central Intelligence. If Colby is the, because he was the director, if he sends you to talk to me, that means that my secrecy, that I don't have to follow my secrecy oath.
There you go.
Told you that I can, said that it's okay. So they have there's an old boy network that, and again, it used to work that way 35 years ago. I don't think it works that way anymore ever since the Patriot Act and 9/11. They've really clamped down on these old-fashioned ways of doing things. But I was lucky, and I got in. And because Colby had vouched for me, the experience I had with Parker happened dozens of times with other CIA guys. And everybody that Parker let me in on, it was the same thing. And it got to the point after 2 years where everybody thought I was a CIA officer.
Oh.
He's okay. CIA.
They thought you were the CIA too.
After 2 years of doing this, I knew more about the Phoenix program than any CIA officer did. Because they're all compartmented. And they work in little, you know, they have their own area that they work
it's
in. And
Douglas,
they didn't.
Douglas, let me interrupt you right there. Everybody, you need to understand the CIA is highly compartmentalized. That means that I know my part, but I don't know your part. And you know your part, but you don't know what the guy next to you is doing. And that's how they keep everybody from finding out the total big picture. So what we have here is Douglas Valentine, who is going around talking to all the different people, picking up all the different pieces and putting them all together putting the puzzle pieces together. That's why he's able to say what he does, which is that he knew more about it than they did, because he was connecting all the different compartmentalized pieces and putting it all together. Continue, Douglas.
Right, and basically, the CIA, well, let me go back one step, because Colby also introduced me to another man. Another senior CIA officer, a guy named Nelson Brigham. And Brigham was in the Foreign Intelligence Branch of the CIA. There's five or six or seven branches of the CIA. But the two main ones are Foreign Intelligence and Covert Action. And Foreign Intelligence is the branch of the CIA that was in charge of working with the special police and the South Vietnamese police force. They're the guys that advised. They were in a liaison relationship with the secret police in any foreign country with which the CIA is aligned. And so they were the guys that were basically running the Phoenix program. And this guy, Nelson Brigham, was actually in 1966 cast with creating the Phoenix program. The station chief in South Vietnam, a guy named John Hart, and a guy who was a senior CIA officer named Robert Culver, who was Lyndon Johnson, President Lyndon Johnson's CIA advisor on pacification in South Vietnam, decided to create the Phoenix program in late 1966. And Culver, who was, like I say, President Lyndon Johnson's advisor on this matter, and the station chief in South Vietnam, a guy named John Hart, gave the task of creating the Phoenix program to Nelson Brigham. And Colby introduced me to Brigham.
Wow.
Brigham's house, and Brigham said, well, Colby and Parker say you're okay.
Ooh, yeah.
That's how I went about creating the Phoenix program. And he had actually in his possession the enabling documents that he composed for Hart and for this guy Culver. There was six or seven of them, which actually showed how the Phoenix program created the Phoenix program. They gave me copies of those documents. Nobody, you know.
Wow.
Nowadays, Britain would be brought up on charges of treason for doing that. You know, I mean, but again, because Colby had sent me to him, because Parker had said I was okay, Brigham thought that it was what I was doing was some kind of sanctioned history of the CIA's involvement in the Phoenix program, and he gave me these documents. And believe me, having these documents.
Oh my God! And let me interrupt you right there for one second. My old defense intelligence handler had been in Vietnam too, and there was a desire in the 90s. What you need to tell me again what year you were doing this in, because there was a need, a psychological need of all these men to get this off their chest.
Yes, and Brigham said as much, and so did Parker to me, that Brigham was quite a character. And he said, you know, When I got to his doorstep, the first question he asked me is, are you a Republican or a Democrat? And I'll stand there and I said, well, you know, I said, I'm a Democrat. You know, I mean, I didn't know what, you know, I said, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. You know, I mean, I would fall into either of those categories, but, you know, I had to pick one, and it was a roll of the dice. And I said, I'm a Democrat. He said, oh, I'm a Democrat too. Come on in. And if you were a Republican, I wouldn't have talked to you because I hate Republicans. And Reagan was the president at the time. And he said the country in Iran-Contra was going through the same thing that Germany had gone through after World War I. And it was a result of the Vietnam syndrome, where the military felt like, and the CIA felt like, the politicians had stabbed them in the back. And, you know, the military and the CIA felt they could have won the Vietnam War, but the politicians cut off aid, you know, Watergate and all sorts of different scandals, My Lai, and to a certain extent, the Phoenix program. And Brigham said, you know, if we had won the war, I'd be a hero. But as it is, you know, nobody knows who I am, and I'd like to be a footnote in history. And so here are all these documents about how we actually went about creating the Phoenix program. And Brigham gave the PhD course in how the CIA is organized. And he you know, delineated how foreign intelligence is different than covert action, how what the role that executive management plays, how the politicians are involved. And all this stuff was documented. So when my book came out, nobody could say I made it up, because I just referred to the documents he gave me. And the CIA just absolutely freaked out, because I wasn't supposed to have these documents, but it was irrefutable what I had done. And so...
Douglas, I love you. So fantastic.
And again, all of this happens because I'm nobody.
Everybody, listen.
They would not have trusted me.
This is Douglas Valentine. You've got to read his book, CIA as Organized Crime. He also wrote several books about the Phoenix program. Anything and everything that he writes, as you can see, you want to know what really happened, that you can see why this is such a valuable sourcing. Please continue.
Yes, so let me add that I tape recorded Evan Parker, and I tape recorded my interviews with Brown, and I tape recorded my interview with Colby, and all these things are available on the internet. I tape recorded these guys on a $25 Radio Shack tape recorder onto, you know, tape, when I would get home, I would, by myself, over a period of days, transcribe the tape that I made. So, and then about 10 years ago, I met some young kids at a nearby college, and they were interested in the Phoenix program, and they took these old Radio Shack tapes that I had, they brought them into the studio at their college, and they digitized them, and they put them on CD. And then, you know, once it's on CD, you can post it on the internet, you know, and now, so all my, if you really want to hear what these guys said to me, it's on the internet.
And
so again, the CIA was really starting to hate me by the time they figured out what I was doing, which was about 2 or 3 years into this project, because I ended up interviewing probably close to 100 CIA officers and military officers who were involved in the Phoenix program. And they were all at the highest level, and they gave me all the documents that they used. So it was irrefutable. But of course,
history. This is the real history, people. You got to check out Douglas Valentine.
So once I found out what I was doing, I didn't really, you know, I after a while, they got to the point where I met a guy named a CIA officer towards the end of my research down in Maryland, and his name was Bob Wall. And he'd been one of these, a CIA officer who, he'd been involved in the Bay of Pigs, and then he was one of the senior advisors to the police special branch, the secret police in Vietnam. I went and I interviewed him, and it was a good interview. And as we were leaving, he just had this little split-level ranch house, again, in Rockville, Maryland, the same place where Parker lived. And we left. He had a little study in his basement, and we went out through the garage, which was on the bottom floor, you know, out to the garage, and we out to the driveway where my car was parked, and we're standing there, and he said, "You know, we know what you're doing." And what we
you don't have a clue, baby.
He said, "But we," he said, I happen to, you know, I mean, we like the way you conduct yourself. You know, you're smart, you're good looking, you're intelligent, you understand the whole thing." He said, "I run a youth leadership program where we select people like yourself for, an introduction into, you know, bring you into government. And there's a position available right now as a staff aide on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And your starting salary, and this is like 1988, would be close to $80,000 a year. And I'll get you into this youth leadership program, and we'll get you a job on the staff of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And all you have to do is turn over your Phoenix program book manuscript to us to edit and make sure that it comes out the way we want it." And I, you know, so I, they were actually making a pass at me to join the CIA. And they figured, you know, well, we'll try the carrot before we try the stick, you know. And
they knew. They had all talked to you. They had to.
You know, I mean, and there were guys that were making passes at me throughout this experience, but nobody had actually made, you know, this kind of a formal recruitment effort. And I looked at them and I said, "Well, thanks, Bob, but I prefer to work for myself." You know, and I went home and I told my father. My father was still very sick, and he said, "Dunny, you should have taken the job. You know, I mean, you should have gone over to the dark side." But, you know, my father was he wanted financial security. He never had any himself. And, you know, I told my wife, Alice, and she said, "Well, you know, I admire you, Dougie, but I didn't take the job." And that's when things, they were already spying on me. And when I finished the book, it got a horrible review in the New York Times. And they chose a guy named Morley Safer, who was at CBS News for 60 Minutes for many years. He'd been one of the ranking members of the Vietnam Press Corps. And when the book came out in 1990, the CIA arranged with the New York Times for Morley Safer to review the book. And even though everything I said in the book was irrefutable, he gave it a bad review, and my publisher at the time, William Morrow, once said, "Well, you know, if you get a bad review in the New York Times, your book is dead. We're not going to spend any money, promoting it."
Everybody, this is a moment to remind everybody that 60 Minutes is on the take with the CIA. And yeah, the CIA gets to review. Do not even think anything, you know, forget this independent media crap or that 60 Minutes is this great investigative unit. All of their, every single video that they shoot is reviewed by the CIA, and the CIA makes the cut, the editing cuts of the...
And the New York Times, too.
The New York Times is a media whore for the establishment and protecting... And I'm amazed that anybody would read or trust that newspaper ever. It's one of the worst newspapers.
So Morley Safer killed the book. And which brings me to two things, okay? The second one, which I'll talk about, is when I filed a Privacy Act request with the CIA, and they actually had to give me the file that they had composed on me. But the first thing is that I didn't know why at the time, the CIA and the New York Times had chosen Safer to do this review. And it wasn't until 2 or 3 years ago that I found out what actually happened behind the scenes. And a friend of mine in Germany had seen on the internet, the State Department had sponsored a Vietnam retrospective in which very important Vietnam War correspondents got together with a bunch of State Department people, and they talked about their Vietnam War experience. And Morley Safer gave a speech at this conference in which he described how in 1970, William Colby called him up one day. And at this time, Morley Safer was a correspondent in South Vietnam reporting on CIA operations and military operations. And Colby was the head of what was called CORDS, Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development, which was the branch of the embassy that the Phoenix program was hidden in. And Phoenix, he was running the Phoenix program through CORDS. And Colby called, and Morley Safer described how Colby called him up one day. And he said to Safer, "Can you disappear for 3 days?" And everybody at the conference laughed. You know, the head of the CIA calls him up, and, you know, and Safer said, "Sure, I can get away for 3 days. And should I bring a film crew with me?" And Colby said, "No. You're not going to be filming anything. You're just going to go with me." And for a couple of days, Safer toured every station, substation base in Da Nang and in 2 Corps and 3 Corps and 4 Corps. He went as Colby toured every major CIA installation and office in South Vietnam. Safer went with him. So he got to know about all these secret interrogation centers. He visited these, the ones I was telling you about earlier in this program, which the CIA built and staffed with these special policemen with her torture chambers. So Safer went with Colby to all these torture chambers. He saw all the different covert action programs that the CIA was running in South Vietnam. And Colby introduced him to all this super secret information. And Safer's telling this to all these people, and it's on the internet. And at the end he said, "You know, and I have never told this story before, and I still feel obligated not to tell anybody what I saw when Colby took me around." So in other words, the CIA introduces these senior correspondents to all its super secrets, and they help keep it secret from us, the American public. So we're the only ones that are deceived, because believe me when I tell you, everybody in South Vietnam knew about these interrogation centers. I mean, they were being dragged to them and tortured.
Oh, yeah. We're the only ones who don't know why we were so hated in Vietnam. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the only people who don't know are the American people. And the only reason they don't know is because schmucks like Morley Safer get introduced, get sucked into this secret club that the CIA has, and they get empowered by it. And their careers are guaranteed as long as they keep the secrets. They're going to get fame and fortune, and that's what happened. And so in 1990, Colby, like the Godfather, like Marlon Brando in that movie, The Godfather, when he says, "You know, I'm going to call in a favor for you. You know, now's your chance to prove your loyalty to the family." Him and the New York Times, got Morley Safer to write the bad review and kill my book. And that's how it works in the United States of America, where you're free to do everything except know what's going on. And the secret cabal of people rule us. And they do it simply because it empowers and enriches themselves at our expense. And this is the nastiness of the system that controls us. And this is how it works. And I, of course, when I wrote the Phoenix Program book, knew that I was going to get skewered eventually. You know, you can't go and reveal the CIA secrets and get away with it, you know, especially the unvarnished secrets, you know. So I knew when I turned down the recruitment, I knew when I published the book, even though William Morrow, my publisher, they never read the book, but I knew I was going to get screwed. And I did, but I just didn't know until like 2 or 3 years ago, Morley Safer did it. And he just died like last year. You know, and I just hate that guy.
Burn in hell, Morley Safer. You and Ahmed Chalabi and all the other
CIA clowns.
You know, yeah.
Because not only did he suppress the truth from the American people, he ruined my career. You know, I mean, it was 10 years before I could get, you know, another book published in the United States. And because, like you said, it's not just CBS. It's just not the New York Times who are in bed with the CIA. It's every major book publisher. And every major book publisher has one of their senior editors who, whenever they get a book about the CIA, calls up Langley and says, you know, this guy has written a book about the CIA.
Everybody, we're coming to the break. This is Douglas Valentine. You gotta read his books. CIA as organized crime. We're talking. We'll be right back, everybody. Hello, are we off the? Hello.
Hi.
Hi there. This is the Covert Report with Susan Lindauer. Are we on the air? Okay, I'm sorry, everybody. I got cut off there for a moment. This is the Covert Report with Susan Lindauer, and we're back with Douglas Valentine. And I'm sorry, I'm working off my old computer, and the clock is running slow on this computer, so it's not timed up with the TFR computer. I apologize for that, everybody. Please continue. You were telling everybody, Douglas, about how the mainstream corporate publishers try to screw people.
Just every day and every way.
Yeah, well, and I can add something to that. I can add something to that. I am the author. Everybody, I apologize for this. If we are trying to get the studio, I think we have the studio. Yay, I think we have the studio. People, I apologize to you. This is Susan Lindauer and the Covert Report with Douglas Valentine. We went out. I apologize to all of you. We were having an intense conversation about Colin Powell and censorship and how the Phoenix program has been brought back to America and has been used for administrative detention. And I want to pick that up right there because that is exactly the moment when they cut us off. And you managed to get that through, and then all of a sudden we were cut off. And I want you to pick up right there, everybody. I apologize for that break. We've been here the whole time trying to get back on. Okay, Douglas.
Thanks for sticking with me. Technical issues, you know, but these, like I was saying before we got cut off, the whole basis for the Phoenix program, I go into this great level of recent book of mine, the CIA Organized Crime, about how the Phoenix program has come home to us. Basically, there has to be a lead reason for being able to bring people into these institutions there to create special police, which follows the FBI in the United States. It investigates, you know, having terrorist ties. Therefore, because I always.
Hello, Doug. Hi. Here we go. Talk before we go out again.
I don't know what happened, but it said that you had gone offline.
Keep going.
Okay. Administrative detention was something that Americans were not subjected to in any kind of systemized way until 9/11. And at that point, very much the judicial system in the United States was restructured. And so now, just like in South Vietnam, anybody can be framed. Anybody can be said to be connected to terrorism. And you forfeit all your rights to a fair trial if these accusations are leveled against you. And there's this kind of limbo, legal limbo, that people are put into. And it's called administrative detention when there aren't, when you haven't actually broken any law, when you're merely suspected of being involved in terrorism, then you can be put into administrative detention, and you can be detained while the government looks around to find evidence to convict you or to charge you with a crime. So, and this was the basis of the Phoenix program in South Vietnam, because people were, it's a way of controlling people politically. You don't have to actually be guilty of breaking any law. You simply have to be charged with a political crime. And this has been the state that we're existing in the United States since 9/11. And believe me, and I outline the processes of how this happened in this book, The CIA's Organized Crime. And it's just a way of like intimidating people and the knowledge that you can be detained without having created a crime is a way of suppressing people from being politically active. And we see it happening all the time. And this is the state of affairs that we've entered into the United States in the 21st century.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what they did. I was one of the very first people to go through that. I was actually the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act after Jose Padilla.
And yeah,
I was not supposed to be the poster child of, you know, because I'm a white woman, like a mom in tennis shoes kind of stuff. I don't have children, but it's the same thing. I'm a soccer mom in tennis shoes. I'm not supposed to be the one that gets indicted. That's why they couldn't have the trial. But once I got indicted, I think we're going out again. Oh my God. Here we go. Oh no, we're still here. Once I was locked up, they refused to release me, and they said that they petitioned the court for the right to detain me up to 10 years.
Yep.
With no trial or hearing. No trial or hearing. And on top of that, not only did they want to detain me, they wanted to forcibly drug me with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac so that I could be chemically lobotomized, so that even while I was in prison, I would not be able to discuss what I had done or in any way fight for my release or become a martyr to the cause of what they were doing. It was absolutely the most terrifying thing ever.
Well, that's right. And because it goes back to medieval times, the whole idea of the star chamber, because the CIA is involved, they say that you don't even have a right to be presented with the charges against you because everything is wrapped in secrecy. In other words, we can detain a person. They don't have a right to a public trial because what they're charged with doing or what they're suspected of doing is secret. And if we have a public trial, then we have to present evidence. And because it's national security, this person doesn't have a right to face their accusers. It doesn't have a right. This is what happened in South Vietnam. A person didn't have a right to an attorney. They didn't have a right to see the evidence that was being used against them because all of that was secret. And this is what the CIA, this is how the CIA exerts its influence in the United States. And it has this chilling effect because even a congressman or a newspaper editor can be charged with connections to terrorism if you simply reveal the truth of what's going on. So the revealing the truth becomes the greatest crime.
Truth becomes treason. Truth becomes treason. Yeah.
That's right. Exactly. Because it's secret. The truth is secret. And you're revealing secrets. Therefore, you're a terrorist or you're sympathizing with terrorists because you're telling, for example, that the United States supports ISIS. Or that the CIA is actually funding money to ISIS. Well, the CIA doesn't want the rest of America to know that it's involved with funneling arms and material support to ISIS because it wants to overthrow the government in Syria. So you're therefore you're a terrorist because you're revealing the fact that the CIA is arming terrorists, and it's this catch 22. And you're not allowed to even they set up these special courts in the United States. They're basically military tribunals, which is how people who were arrested under the Phoenix program, they weren't tried in regularly constituted courts. They were tried in these Stalinist military tribunals because they had the trials themselves had to be conducted in secret because suspected of being linked to other terrorists. Well, we can't reveal that information in court. So it has to be, the court itself has to be secret. So everything now, anything that's connected to the CIA now, well, anybody can be framed on these charges too. And that's exactly what I was trying to warn people about when I started writing these books, is that you don't have to do anything wrong. You can be framed, but because you can't produce any evidence in your defense in a court in a public trial, anybody can be trumped up on these charges just like you were. And it doesn't matter if the truth is on your side. If you're politically incorrect, you can be sent into administrative detention, and the government can shield you from can basically imprison you as long as it wants, and there's no recourse.
Douglas, we're coming. Everybody, this is Douglas Valentine. I apologize that we got cut off. This was an interference. This was an interference from outside forces that cut us off. I apologize to everybody for that. But this is a very important book. Douglas, tell everybody the title of your book and where they can get it.
Okay,
you've got to read this book.
The one that describes this entire evolution, which, you know, of which you were subjected
to. We're coming to the end of the show, so very quickly.
CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. And you can get it from Clarity Press. It's just Google it. Amazon has it. It's all over the place.
Yes, Amazon has got it. It's published by Clarity Press. The CIA as Organized Crime, and again, ironically, that this book it talks about how the Phoenix Program has been brought to the United States in the guise of the Patriot Act, and how the Patriot Act is an evolution of the Phoenix Program. And I apologize to all of our listeners that we got cut off for 20 minutes at the key moment when we were coming to how this comes to the future and how this plays out. I apologize to everybody. Douglas, I hope you're going to do lots of radio interviews because this story is so important. And they are reacting.
Yes, and it's the most important story of our times.
Yes, it is. It is the most important story for freedom and truth seekers and people who are communicating. You know, we're seeing the censorship that is rising. I will tell you that it used to be the Republicans and the right who were associated with the neocons doing it, but now you see the left pushing massive surveillance and massive censorship. It's always relevant when you're trying to control freedom of speech, to control the government's narrative so that the government can dictate to the people. It's more prevalent with globalism than ever before. So thank you, everybody. I apologize that we got cut off for that 20 minutes. And everybody, check out Douglas Valentine. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Susan.